You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Once there was a princess.
Was the princess you?
And she fell in love.
Was it hard to do?
It was very easy. Anyone could see that the prince was charming. The only one for me.
Was he strong and handsome?
Was he big and tall?
There's nobody like him. Anywhere at all.
Did he say he loved you?
Did he steal a kiss?
He was so romantic, I could not resist.
Slightly unusual start to Past Prologue 4 2018. Finn, explain, why have we gone all Disney?
Well, back in November, I think it was November, we had an announcement of a royal wedding.
And just in time for this show, of course. Indeed. They're like buses. You wait for years and suddenly you get two, three. It's a phenomenal.
Yes, I was wondering if it was all part of a scheme on behalf of Princess Eugene and Jack Brookbank, I think, to sort of be... able to
get into Past Prologue.
But there's
a waiting list.
Sort of not be too much attention, so because it'll all be focusing on Prince Harry. But I'm sure our guests will have views on that question,
Finn,
and others.
Please take it away.
So we have with us today to talk about things royal weddingy and celebrity. Is weddingy a word? Probably not. We'll carry on. Dr. Ed Owens, one of our modern British historians, and Dr. Antonella Liuzzo Scopo. One of our medieval historians. And we're going to start with Ed. And I wonder if we could begin by thinking about when do the first modern royal weddings take place that would sort of fit into a pattern that we can see perhaps being about to be repeated with the two recent announcements?
Well, if we characterise modern royal weddings as defined by ideas of sort of mass participation, sort of characterised by sense that these things are on a national scale, transmitted by new kinds of media, emphasising ideas of true love between the royal couple, then I think we can date this to about 100 years ago, to 1919, immediately after the First World War, and to a little-known wedding involving Princess Patricia of Connaught, a relative of King George V, and her husband, Alexander Ramsay. So for the first time in more than five centuries, for the first time in more than 500 years, we have a royal wedding that takes place in Westminster Abbey. The last royal wedding to take place in Westminster Abbey was that of King Richard II and Anne of Bohemia in 1382. And in 1919, we have this romantic story unfold at the centre of London in Westminster Abbey, and what follow then is a succession of very similar royal weddings, first in 1922 between Princess Mary, the daughter of King George V, to Viscount Lascelles. In 1923, we have the Duke and Duchess of York, the future King George VI, and Queen Elizabeth. And then in 1934, perhaps most spectacularly in terms of the sort of the modern genre of royal love stories, the modern genre of royal weddings, we have the wedding of Princess Marina of Greece to Prince George, the youngest son of King George V, who later becomes Duke of Kent.
So, can you say a bit more about the particular reasons why that first one in 1919 leads to this change in the genre, as it were? Because I must confess, I think of myself as having some idea of the history of the royal family in Britain, as a non-expert, but I don't think I'd ever been aware of that particular couple or that wedding until you were talking just now.
And I think 1919 is, it sort of starts this domino effect of these important interwar royal weddings. Well, what motivates them, I think, are four probable factors. First of all, we have King George V's desire to distance the House of Windsor from his European cousinhood of royalties. Thinking back before the First World War, pre-1914, it is usual for young British royals to marry in to other European royal families. Famously, we have Queen Victoria, who becomes known as the Grandmother of Europe, because she is her children go off and marry the various princelings, kings, queens, and princesses of these various European houses. But with the First World War, there is a desire on the part of the royal household and King George V to distance his royal house, the now renamed House of Windsor, from European royalty, to distance it from the Kaiser, to distance it from the Tsar. So he enables his children to marry British aristocrats from the Scottish and English nobility. And so therefore we see a shift to his children marrying, with the exception of Prince George in 1934, into the English and Scottish nobility. Equally, these new royal weddings are driven by publicity. New forms of mass communication, like newsreel, the photographic press, later radio. So news editors, just as much as courtiers, are responsible for orchestrating royal weddings. There's also a new culture of celebrity and emotion. More than ever, the British public are infatuated with private life, with the idea of true love as something that they can all buy into, that they can all invest in. And there is a public hunger for royal weddings in that respect. And in terms of the media coverage of these events, it's feeding this desire, this interest in royal gossip and royal tittle-tattle. And finally, and I think perhaps most significantly, in terms of why these royal weddings are staged and orchestrated in the way they are as these big national events, we've got to think to the broader political and social context. The 1920s and 1930s are remarkably unstable, characterised by the rise of Bolshevism, specifically the 1920s, but also great economic instability and concerns about eventually the rise of political extremism as well. And therefore we see the royal family and the royal household orchestrating these royal weddings in order to elevate monarchy as a symbolic focal point for the nation at a time of great instability. In this more democratic period, in a period defined by these new cultures of emotion and celebrity, royal weddings are staged in such a way that ordinary people can emotionally invest in them, they buy into them, and they sort of, the royal family, they come to venerate the royal family and this culture of romance which encircles them.
Is there sort of any pushback on this? I'm sort of thinking, do you get people saying, oh, it's terrible that the royal family is dumbing down by marrying, you know, they're marrying beneath them. Is there anything of that going on, or is there a broader sort of acceptance of this?
I think shift? In this more democratic age, in 1918, of course, we have the Fourth Reform Act, the 1918 Representation of the People Act, which is only, its centenary is less than a month away. In this more democratic age, where the working classes, the masses are more important than ever before, I think news editors, but equally the public alike, value the fact that the royal family can be seen to be engaging with commoners, to be marrying below themselves. It is a concerted democratising effort on the part of the royal family and the royal household. But I think that is certainly valued by the British press and public. And the press spin it. they see this marrying of commoners as true love stories, whereas once the European royal love matches of the pre-1914 period were seen as sort of as dynastic intermarriages, not rooted in concepts of true romance, more about politics. Now, because George V's children are seen to choose their partners, more than ever before, these stories are defined by idealised concepts of love and emotional fulfilment.
And does this move into the culture beyond, obviously, its representation in the media and the way people are identifying with these couples is a very strong dynamic here. Mm. But I'm wondering also, you mentioned in advance your ideas about sort of fashion and so on, and I'm wondering whether are we seeing the kind of thing that you know we see now, where the sort of fashion choice, you know, the choice of dress and the merchandising around these events has in itself become a phenomenon.
Absolutely, and I think again this can be unpacked. This can be explained in relation to a broader culture of consumerism that emerges in the 20s and 30s. We have, for the first time, working class women have new kinds of access to glamour, to fashion, to clothing, and royal brides are presented in such a way as to appeal to this new audience, this new cultural interest in these particular things. We have the consumerization of royal family life, of the royal bride, as it is. I think more spectacularly than any other example would be the case of Princess Marina of Greece, renowned as this sort of chic icon. Chic is the word that they continually use, the press, to characterise her in 1934, following her engagement to Prince George, Duke of Kent. And she is sort of, she comes across from the continent. She's been living in exile in France, in Paris. She comes across from the continent and she's fated as sort of reinvigorating the style, the fashion, and the glamour of the royal of the House of Windsor, which has by this point been seen to become a bit dated, a bit fusty, and she draws on this continental glamour to redefine how members of the public see the House of Windsor.
Is there a broader connection to the continent linked to that? I mean, is this a period when more people from Britain are going over there, or in which continental styles are being seen as coming across to Britain, or is it very much, you know, is she very much the spearhead for something like that?
Well, the great example I think that we can point to here is Vogue. Vogue is a magazine that really takes off in the 20s and 30s as a publication that is purchased by all classes, and it sort of triangulates between New York, Paris, and London. These are the three fashion centres. So there is this sort of transatlantic, transnational, transcontinental culture of glamour and fashion, which I think Marina very carefully captures, very deliberately captures in 1934. She's got a problematic story. She is this exiled Greek princess from not a particularly popular dynasty. She's been living in penury. She comes from a fairly impoverished group of royals. And yet she's fated as the most glamorous woman in the world in 1934. And she draws on her renowned fashion style, her difference, if you like, her otherness, in order to sell herself, first of all, to the British public, but equally to the British press as well.
So does she come over deliberately sort of husband hunting to Britain, or have they met before she arrived there? Because obviously there's almost been a reverse of that with the Harry and Meghan Markle story, where there seems to be sort of some suggestion he set out to, you know, he decided that he wanted to make contact with her, and of course he, moving in the circles he does, you have a certain ability to do that.
Well, it's interesting you say that. The 1934 royal wedding is fated as the greatest romance to ever before the House of Windsor. It's the greatest ever romance between a young British royal and another person, who in this instance is Princess Marina. And yet, in terms of the origins of this relationship, highly suspect. There has been rumour and speculation that this is actually a more recent version of an older kind of royal marriage, which is a dynastic intermarriage, based upon sort of Greek and British royal blood ties. mainly because Prince George was a bit of a troublemaker. We know that he was bisexual, that he had various bouts of sort of drug addiction, and there were various other stories sort of circulating around him in the early 1930s. And the story goes that his mother, Queen Mary, Queen Consort to King George V, was desperately searching for someone to marry him off to, someone who was responsible, someone who was who the British public would take to their hearts. And of course, Princess Marina, just across the English Channel, very beautiful, very glamorous, very respectable, despite her sort of impoverished circumstances. And he flies out in August 1934 to the Yugoslavian Alps, where he meets Princess Marina at a cousin's home. And according to the press reports, at least, there, within a space of a week, they fall dramatically in love, and the rest is history.
Crystal's Going to the Chapel. And we're going to turn now for a few minutes to speak to Antonella. And we were sort of seeing a kind of two versions of royal marriage in the last segment, kind of ideas about dynastic marriages as a dynastic alliance and marriages made for love. And I suppose when I would think about the medieval period, I would tend to think that it would be the dynastic alliance that would be the dominating basis for royal weddings. But does love come into it at all?
That's an interesting question, Finn. Well, you are absolutely right. When we think about medieval weddings, we think about marital policies tend to be based on diplomatic agreement to strengthen peace, truces between nations, between different families. So in principle and overall, I would say, yes, that is the case. However, it doesn't mean that there are no references to the possibility that some of those marriages happened because love was there. And there's actually a very interesting source, which is a chronicle by Froissart. It's a very interesting chronicle to begin with, because although we call it a chronicle, when you read it, really reads like a romance, like Ed was mentioning before. I mean, the chronicle covers really the events concerning the Hundred Year War, but there's a lot of focus on supposedly what happens, let's say, behind the scenes. And in particular, there's the narration about what happened between King Charles VI when he married Isabel of Bavaria. And this happened in 1385 when Charles was only 17 and Isabel was 14, which in medieval standard, that was actually, they were more than adults when you consider that canon law allowed basically individuals to marry by the age of 12. However, there are exceptions. If you want, we can talk about that as well. But what is interesting is, so the description, first of all, of the first time that they met and how much Charles VI admired this young princess and how he fell in love with her, to the extent that, in fact, the engagement only lasted 2 days because he couldn't resist her and he had to marry her within 2 days. However, when you read the chronicle, and then there's the description of the wedding, which is also quite interesting. I'm going to talk about this maybe in a minute. But what is nice is when you start reading between the lines, not even between the lines, I think Froissart really let it out in different ways. First of all, because it describes what happens to Isabel of Bavaria when she gets there, and with obviously all the retinue of ladies and noblemen, etc. And she's examined by the ladies to make sure that her body is fit enough to bear children, which is already in something that tell us about what weddings are, as a means of producing heirs, a means of legitimization for the dynasty. And then Froissart continues saying how Charles was, how much he was impressed by the fact that she was so quiet, so well behaved, so silent. But then a few lines after, he actually admits that Isabel didn't speak or understand French. So no wonder that he was there sitting and being in silence, because she couldn't even engage with what was happening really around her. So basically what Froissart is doing is trying to create this image of Charles the VI in a context that it does of chivalric models that are becoming prominent, and for a king to be chivalrous is really the best promotion that he can do of himself. So clearly what we have here is a wedding or a marriage that not differently from others, has got clear political, dynastic, diplomatic implications, and yet is described in the context, obviously, of this chronicle as something that would claim ideas of love and actually of passion, because he said very clearly that he couldn't resist the idea of being with her. And then the wedding is also, the description of the wedding is quite interesting, because it tells us that Isabel went accompanied by very lavish carriages, that the king sent her a crown that she was supposed to wear even before getting to see him. And then after the mass was celebrated, they go into the bishop's palace to have their feast, which happened separately. So the ladies celebrate with the bride and the king celebrates with his noblemen. And the feast lasts for the entire day until the ladies put the bride in bed, which is quite interesting because, and here I open a bracket, this is part of the rituals that still happen with traditional weddings nowadays in Sicily, where supposedly all the girlfriends of the bride really take her to her bedroom before. Anyway, close bracket, modern Sicilian bracket. But what happens in the end is, I said, that the ladies had to leave Isabel because Charles couldn't wait anymore and he had to be with her in the bedroom. So I think it's a mix, and we find sources that try to depict this emotional level that perhaps might have been there, although obviously that we will never know.
Is his first encounter with her when she turns up at the, as it were, I don't know, the castle or wherever he happens to be? So, because I'm wondering about, is there a sort of social scene in medieval Europe where royals can meet each other, or is it the case that, you know, the chancellor of one monarchy writes to the chancellor of the other and says, right, I've got an eligible daughter here and we need to improve diplomatic relations.
Yeah,
and,
that's exactly what happened. And actually, the chronicle gives a full list of all the noblemen and noble lady who accompanied her from Bavaria to France. And also, they clearly said that they are hoping that the king is going to accept her straight away. Otherwise, that's the start of a war, or nearly, because her honour and that of her family would be compromised. So, yes, they're not going to meet as Harry and Meghan did, I guess. And although, as we know, the courts were the place, if you like, well, at least when we think about 13th century and beyond, some kind of encounters might happen, but clearly that is not the case. And these are, I don't want to say that daughters were sent as gifts, but there's a clear negotiation procedure that is in place, and Froissart actually describes that in details. I'm not going to give you all the names of the nobles and dukes who were there because I don't remember. But if you read the chronicles, that is clearly the case.
And we were talking a bit about media with Ed a few moments ago, and obviously Froissart's chronicle is intended to present a certain version of this to the people who could read it. But I imagine the majority of the populations would not have been able to do so. Are there ways in which these events, or that we know of, that these events are sort of filtered out to the non-literate part of the population, or is that something we don't know a lot about?
Well, that is the thing. And again, if we refer, for example, to the same chronicle that also describes later on the coronation of the same Isabel, etc., then we read about supposedly the fact that the entire Paris, a city of Paris, came into the street to welcome the new queen, well, by then after the wedding. So there is an idea that these events clearly were part of, as Ed was suggesting, something that was affecting a much broader context than just the court. Now, whether the recording of those weddings is something that became accessible to a wider audience, then is a big question mark, because as you were pointing out, obviously, who was going to be able to read that chronicle is another story. But the actual wedding, the rite was already, that obviously would have involved, especially because at some point there are references to additional celebration, not in this specific case, but we know of weddings that were celebrated and, for example, accompanied by a few days before or after, like a tournament or something. So that was the kind of scenario that was the kind of modern day sports and tournaments. We know that everybody was participating, not in terms of fighting, but as audiences. So there are clearly, these were ceremonies, events that implied also rituals that involved a lot more of people than just the court or the noble group, if you like. But whether what we know about them, so the recording, if you like, of them was then accessible, is different.
Yes.
Can't find my shoes. Today is for Amy. Amy, I give you the rest of my life to cherish and to keep you, to honor you forever. Today is for Amy, my happily soon to be wife. Amy, we're really getting married.
Pardon me, is everybody there? Because if everybody's there, I want to thank you all for coming to the wedding. I'd appreciate you going even more. I mean, you must have lots of better things to do, and not a word of it to Paul. Remember, Paul, you know the man I'm going to marry, but I'm not, because I wouldn't ruin anyone as wonderful as he is. But I thank you all for the gifts and the flowers. Thank you all. Now it's back to the showers. Don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
His good cufflinks.
They're on the dresser. Right next to my suicide note. Listen, everybody, look, I don't know what you're waiting for. A wedding, what's a wedding? It's a prehistoric ritual where everybody promises fidelity forever, which is maybe the most horrifying word I've ever heard, and which is followed by a honeymoon where suddenly he'll realize he's settled with Annette and want to kill me, which he chose to listen. Thanks a bunch, but I'm not getting married. Go have lunch, because I'm not getting married. You've been grand, but I'm not getting married. Don't just stand there, I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today. Go, can't you go? Why is nobody listening? Goodbye, go and cry at another person's wake. If you're quick for a kick, you could pick up a christening. But please, on my knees, there's a human life at stake. Listen, everybody, I'm afraid you didn't hear. Do you want to see a crazy lady fall apart in front of you? It isn't only Paul who may be ruining his life. You know, we'll both of us be losing our identities. I telephoned my analyst about it, and he said to see him Monday. But by Monday, I'll be floating in the Hudson with the other garbage. I'm not well, so I'm not getting married. You've been swell, but I'm not getting married. Clear the hall, because I'm not getting married. Thank you all, but I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
Bless this bride, totally insane, slipping down the drain. And bless this day in our hearts as it starts to rain.
Today.
You know, I adore you all, but why don't we die like Eliza on the ice? Look, perhaps I'll collapse in the abs right before you. Also, take back the cake, burn the shoes, and boil the rice. Look, I don't want to have to tell you, but I may be coming down with hepatitis, and I think I'm going to faint. So if you want to see me faint, I'll do it happily. But wouldn't it be funnier to go and watch a funeral? So they give her the 27 dinner plates, the 37 butter knives, and 37 red plates, and they're going to get all of
this. One more thing.
I am not getting married.
Amen.
But I'm not getting married.
Amen.
Still, I'm not getting married.
Amen.
See, I'm not getting married.
Amen.
Let us pray that we're not
getting
married.
Beth, at least I think it's Beth in Sondheim's company, I may be getting the name wrong, going slowly mad on her way to the altar. I can happily say, however, that in fact by the end of the show she has got married and decided it's all going to be all right after all. So we're not sending out negative messages about any of the looming royal weddings that have occasioned the theme for this show. So coming back to both my guests here, we were talking a little bit while we were off air just then about whether the definition of love has changed between these two periods. And so I thought we might start there for the next segment. And Antonella, I don't know what you're... How exactly are they thinking about the idea of love in your period?
Great. Have I got 7 hours to discuss this? I think it's... So first of all, it's a very complex idea. And when we think about love, first of all, we have to look at the terminology itself, and it's interesting because in many cases coincide with the idea of divine love, with the idea of friendship. It's actually interesting because in some cases when they use the term amicizia, they might refer, so friendship, they actually refer to non, kind of slightly legal, for example, or relationships that have got some kind of sexual implication. Sometimes they refer to love when they actually mean friendship, and so on. If we are talking about romantic love, which I guess is what we're referring to in this context, then again, it's interesting the fact that in the medieval period, one of the perhaps predominant discourses is what we know as courtly love. Now, the definition itself is a 19th century historiographical label, but what it defines is these ideas that, again, appear, as in the chronicle I was talking about before, of the emotional levels that that is there, and it's not just about marriage, about weddings and so on. What is interesting, though, is that there are, so there's this idea that a woman is usually an ennobling force that has to push a knight, usually it's a knight, obviously a nobleman already, to improve himself. Love is also something that causes constantly some kind of suffering. And it's also interesting the fact that it has to be not
Nothing's really changed then.
Exactly. not to be consumed in order to be the perfect relationship. So actually, in a lot of medieval romances, we see the triangle, right? So it's the knight who falls in love for the noble lady who's also the wife of his lord. So there's the tension of loyalty. Do you have to be more loyal to your lady or to your lord? And how is that going to develop? So it is very complex, I would say, but there is also, is a discourse that is created through very different types of sources, without even mentioning the fact that we can look at it in different from different perspectives. So there are sources, it depends what sources we look at. Needless to say, there's a very interesting 12th century treaty called De Amore. So it's a treaty on love, by the way, written by a cleric, which is really interesting. And he goes all over the places, because you look at the first part of the source and it's all about the noble function of love and how this is important, how this, all these things. And then you look at the second part of the same treaty, and he actually, as if he had a sudden change of mind, and he goes, well, but do remember that women are the evil, and that you can be corrupted by those feelings, by an excess of passion, etc. And that's when being a medievalist, you kind of go like, wait a moment, what is this actually? What are we talking about? And then you start realizing that he was a cleric, but he was also commissioned, or anyway, his patroness was Mary de France. So perhaps that's why the contradiction. On the one hand, you are paid by somebody who clearly wants you to talk and say nice things about love. On the other is your very same office that invites you to remind in a very didactic way about the dangers of love. So it's very difficult to kind of come up with a one definition. I would say that we have to look at different sources from different perspectives to have very different ideas on what love might mean.
And picking up on that point, I think when we get to the 1920s, 1930s, definitions of love are again in flux. They're always changing. They mean love means different things to different people. For example, if we think of Mary Stopes, her famous text, Married Love, aimed at sort of popularising new concepts of intimacy, of sexual fulfilment between couples in the 1920s, very popular amongst the middle classes. It's this idea of intimacy, emotional fulfilment, of companionship that was at the heart of middle class marriages, or at least she wanted it to be in the 1920s and 1930s. And we do see this take off in relation to middle class life in this period. The working class is a little bit slower, a little bit further behind, but historians of the 20th century have traditionally associated sort of modern concepts of love with the post-1945 period. But I think in terms of the royal weddings of the 20s and 30s, we can see the sort of the blueprint of modern love being presented through these stories. For example, if we look at 1934 in the royal wedding of Prince George and Princess Marina, this is supposedly a relationship defined by like-mindedness. The press and the couple are at pains to emphasise the fact that they like going to the cinema together. They like reading. They like going to art galleries. They like going to the theatre. They like smoking. They like driving around in fast cars. This idea of shared interests as something that is necessary to the success of a relationship, that is sort of taking off as an idea that is intrinsic to ideas of romance. Equally, it's about sexual attraction. The British media and the American media, I think the American influence here is important, especially with sort of Hollywood celebrity, the focus on the female form, but equally the focus on the male form, the focus on the body, as a point of attraction, the physicality of love. This really sort of takes off in the 20s and 30s as well, the glamorization of love. And we have, in personal testimonies written by working class but equally middle class people as well in relation to royal weddings, discussion of the physical beauty of these royal figures, comparisons to Hollywood celebrities, for example, which brings us, of course, to the present day.
Yes, so do we see it as having carried through? Are all those kind of things operating in the same way now with the current round of royal weddings, or has it evolved further again, do you think?
I think she, because specifically Meghan Markle has her Hollywood background, I think this is the most interesting example so far of a blurring of sort of lines in terms of the celebrity on the one hand of the British royal family, who have for a long time, for almost 100 years, been closely associated with sort of the film culture of the USA, most notably in the figure of Edward VIII, who abdicated, who was a frequent holidayer over in the USA. But this is the most notable blurring of these two brands of celebrity. Royalty unique because it's royalty. But Meghan Markle brings another kind of sort of glamour, which is based again on her knowability to some extent. When I
first heard that she was marrying Harry, I had to do some preparation in terms of various interviews and things like that on her, because I didn't know her very well. I didn't know much about her personality. But the more I read, I realised that she has got this mass following. She's got pages and pages of sort of fan. A fan following on the internet, and I think that is quite unique in terms of where we are right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. Our very own pop princess, now queen of pop, has a special announcement she would like to make.
I think I'm ready for my close-up. Yeah. You don't like me, I don't like you, it don't matter. Only difference, you still listen, I don't have to. In one ear and out the other, I don't need ya. Your words don't stick, I ain't perfect, but you ain't either. If you're feeling froggy,
the lights, Britney Spears. I thought we might sort of jump off from where we stopped a moment ago, talking about the fact that Meghan Markle has this fan base from the career she's carved out before having become engaged to Harry. And I was just wondering, to what extent, obviously now we perhaps think of these royal weddings as these partnerships as being people, a situation where both partners might have a sort of public role. Is that the case, and was that the case with these earlier marriages, or was it the case that earlier on you would have thought of the female partner as being much more consigned to a kind of domestic role? The job is to produce the heir, and otherwise you've really got no sort of public, you know, appear at the occasional public occasion, and that's about it.
It's interesting. With the Meghan Markle and Prince Harry relationship, we've seen her very quickly integrated into, if you like, the House of Windsor's fold in terms of duty, ideas of public service. She's had to relinquish both her celebrity, if you like, her Hollywood star. She's no longer going to be an actress. I think that's really interesting. So she's had to sort of cut herself off from her past. Equally, and I think somewhat disappointingly, she's had to give up her feminist politics. She was a very outspoken advocate on behalf of African-American women, but women in general. She's given a number of speeches, notably at the UN, on behalf of the modern women's movement, advocating equal rights. Interestingly, as soon as the engagement was announced, we saw her, as I say, welcomed into the Windsor fold, and that idea of the Windsor role, which is going out, meeting the crowds, going and opening leisure centres, going and you know, it's the sort of the civic publicness of royalty. In the past, it was certainly the case in the 20s and 30s that when the daughter and son of George V identified their partner and married their partner, that those partners also took on active public roles. Again, with the 20s and 30s, it's interesting that at the same time that royal weddings are taking off in their modern guise, at the same time, if you like, the royal public role is being sort of reorientated around publicness. And notably, the wives and husbands of the children of King George V do play these very public roles as ambassadors. Perhaps Princess Marina most famously as the ambassador for Wimbledon, and the Wimbledon Tennis Championship. She went on to fulfil that role year after year, presiding over the trophy ceremony at the end of the competition, and that's now a role fulfilled by her son, the now Duke of Kent. But that's what we kind of see.
It's interesting. I'll come to you in a minute, but it's interesting. I hadn't realised or picked up on all that aspect of what's happened with Meghan Markle since the engagement. It just strikes me that there's almost a sort of a double standard, and one that whether by accident or not, is gendered, in that she's being told that she's being told she can't go on speaking out on some of those things, when of course there's a lot been, you know, virtually continuous controversy about Charles speaking out on all sorts of issues on which he feels strongly that might not necessarily fit with or are sometimes seen as not fitting with the appropriate demeanour of the monarchy.
Yes, I think there is an interesting double standard here, as you say, Finn. Certainly between the heir to the throne, Prince Charles, who, as we know, has been very politically outspoken on certain issues. It could be perhaps the fact that Meghan has had to sort of relinquish this feminist role, perhaps a broader sign of how royal women are expected to behave, and that is not to speak out on politically charged issues. I think it was Hilary Mantel who famously said of Kate Middleton, now Duchess of Cambridge, that she was nothing more than essentially a glorified womb. And it goes back to Antonella's point that ultimately, she was a sort of a cipher for all of these meanings about glamour, about beauty. But ultimately, she is going to bear what is going to be our king. She has borne little Prince George, but Hilary Mantel sort of reduced the figure famously of Catherine Middleton to, as I say, a glorified womb. Not very fair, I don't think, but an interesting one, suggesting that royal women's role is still intrinsically domestic, intrinsically sort of family-centred in nature. And I think maybe we do see this probably in terms of Meghan Markle having to take a step back out of the political limelight.
Fame, but you're there where things are hollow. Fame.
David Bowie with Fame. And we're running, as ever, rapidly out of time. So as a final question, and looking towards these impending weddings, how often do these love matches or otherwise work out happily? Can we quantify in any sort of way the outcome of these marriages? Should we be optimistic or pessimistic on behalf of any new contracts?
I think, interestingly, when royal love is pursued outside the confines of Christian family life, most notably in the case of Edward VIII, who abdicated over his love for Wallis Simpson. Later, though, in terms of both Princess Margaret, her relationship with Peter Townsend, and then finally with Prince Charles and Princess Diana, where love is pursued outside of that, the Christian confines of family life, because that domestic ideal is still so intrinsic to the way we see the royal family, so intrinsic to their public image, I think that will be that is where the test lies. So it depends whether Harry and Meghan, interestingly divorced, can uphold the image of a pure Christian, happy domestic life. It will be very interesting to see over the course of the next decade or so what exactly happens.
That's another.
Well, I think if they look back at medieval times, maybe they don't find really good examples. I think I hardly ever found a king who only married once. Well, obviously, longevity is one thing, but also we have to consider and take into place politics. We also have to consider the fact that if somebody didn't bear the many heirs, that would have gone straight into repudiation, cases of divorce. And there were also plenty of lovers and concubines, and actually concubinage was considered a second-class marriage that existed. So, yeah, maybe medieval times they were a little bit more free when it comes to maintaining their bonds.
Well, at least they can rest in securing the knowledge that we're not likely to be going down the Henry VIII route of beheading anybody who doesn't fulfil appropriate ideals of behaviour or production of offspring or anything like that. We have rushed to the end of another past prologue. I think we could have gone on talking for some time on this subject. I'd like to thank, as ever, both my guests, Dr. Ed Owens and Dr. Antonella Lewis Liuzzo-Scorpo. I'm stumbling over my name today. I'd also like to thank Alex Lefchuk, as ever, for keeping us technically on the air, sorting out all the music and all these things. And thank you, as ever, for listening. And Past Prologue will be back in about a month's time. That the revolution's near, but to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating. The joke is right.